From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, who in a brief period of filmmaking has come up with a few films with enormous detail, and if you're a fan of her work, you remember the kind of details, such as using a bread knife to slice a pint of ice cream in half in her short Sunday, or so many beautiful details in her new film, her feature film directing debut, After Sun, which has won the Gossamer Award, the award from the National Society of Film Critics, and the New York Film Critics Circle, of course, competed at Cannes. I'm talking to the writer-director, Charlotte Wells. Charlotte, so great to have you here. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
There is such a great eye for that detail. I just, watching After Sun, just thought so much about Sunday. With the opening, we see your protagonist stitching that sweater together. And then near the end, she's stringing that guitar by hand. And actually, for me, the suspense was she going to tune it by ear? That really is a very suspenseful moment. And one of the things that you're so good at doing, I think, and it's so prevalent in After Sun, is the kind of suspense that comes from watching sort of quotidian real-life details being worked out.
Yeah, it's been interesting. People have been drawn to that aspect of it recently, and it's something that's difficult to speak to in some ways, because I think it is, like, going back to that for short, is somewhat inherent in what I'm doing. And there are times that I lean into it, and other times I think it is just a product of how I go about making films.
Well, it seems like it's really kind of key to your sensibility, because we're talking about details, and there's a thing that kind of runs through your work, which is we're often overhearing snatches of conversation that we have to decide as viewers how important that conversation is. So this detail is all kind of stuff that you lay out for the viewer to make our own decisions about.
I mean, I've spoken quite a bit about accumulation, but I think that's what it is. I think I'm drawn to details and actions that, you know, are derived from like either memory or just fiction. Yeah, it allowing them to build and accumulate and sometimes circle back and allow one action to reference another, all in service of really building to a feeling.
I guess I wanted to say, too, and ask you, because you have certainly quite an eye for casting young women. And between the two young women in Sunday and the star of After Sun, we really sort of understand them as the film progresses. Because so often, and I wonder if you ran into this in casting, child actors kind of announce themselves in ways, and that doesn't really happen in either of these films.
Yeah, a casting director once referred to some younger performers as twirlers. And that they, you know, feel compelled to do that twirl when they enter a room. And I think that definitely speaks to like a style of performing. But I'm definitely always drawn toward a naturalism in performance. And yeah, looking for people who can find, if not themselves, something truthful in front of the camera. And that was infused certainly in After Sun throughout the casting process, is how you discover that, especially remotely. I mean, I suppose remote casting has, I never really thought of this, but there were advantages to it in that so much was recorded and you could see people's comfort in front of the camera and you could see that evolve and grow over the course of the casting process.
And it certainly, yeah, lends itself to the actual, the literal framing around the film. The beauty of that recording is a big part of the storytelling process in After Sun.
Yeah, it is. And in that regard, I mean, we had the capacity during that process, the audition process, to put the camera in these kids' hands and to invite them to show us what about the world they were drawn to as a way to discover who they were. And that was a part of the process when we got to filming that I was most excited about, because there was something so freeing in it. And even though many of those scenes were scripted, if not most, there was still a huge element of discovery in them because the camera was so loose and free.
I want to ask you about your young actor, your young star, Frankie Corio. I wonder what it was like for her to pick up that video camera, which for her must have felt like some kind of strange artifact.
It's interesting because, of course, she lives with a camera and a phone in her hand. And so there's something very familiar about filming herself. And yet the DV camera was completely foreign. And so there was a novelty in that for her. as there was a novelty in that for me at her age, even though we're separated by 25 years, you know? And I think that was interesting because one thing I did observe about Frankie in the casting process is that she was very much a kid of 2020, 21, now 22, now 23, geez. Yeah, it was something I wasn't quite sure how to reconcile because there were kids that we met who felt very much out of time, who didn't really interact with modern technology. And that really isn't Frankie. You know, I think her early videos were TikTok videos, if not in spirit, then maybe actually. I don't know, she found in that camera, in that DV camera, kind of what she needed. The curiosity was there. And it felt quite genuine and it felt appropriate to the discovery of that in the period. And it does operate differently and you view it differently. It's much harder to see yourself in it than it is in contemporary phones where you can flip the camera around. But it was interesting watching her discover that aspect of it. And there's this photograph from behind the scenes of Greg, the cinematographer, and I sharing a headphone and listening as she was on the top deck of a boat recording the DV. Obviously, we couldn't be there because she could swing the camera in any direction and often did. Just how exciting it felt listening to that and knowing that we were getting something so special, even though we couldn't see a frame, just hearing how she was speaking to the camera and performing for it. It was another layer of, you know, performance within the film.
It's the treatment. I'm talking to the award-winning filmmaker, writer-director of the film After Sun, Charlotte Wells. You can also see the show, kcrw.com/thetreatment. As you're describing that moment, it just reminds me of this, again, that current that runs through the shorts of yours I've seen in After Sun, of just how much hearing things and making our own decisions about the weight of those pieces of information, oral information we get. And you're experiencing that while your star was swinging the camera around and using that DV. You just listen to that audio, what that does for you. This really makes me wonder about the way you use sound. And it's in a really natural way, not just dialogue, but even the way the music is selected in After Sun. The selections are mostly the kinds of things that when you're trapped somewhere, somebody picks for you rather than being curated by a filmmaker.
Yeah, it was a really fine balance that I for a long time, I thought that at the end of the day, we would switch out a lot of the songs that I'd chosen. And I chose them trying to find songs that both evoke the period, not too strongly in that they would distract from scenes. And if I knew a song too well, it would be almost impossible for me to focus on the performance of the cutting of the scene because I would hear the song first and foremost. But also songs that did feel appropriate to this holiday. And there was a lot of discovery in using music because the sound is so deliberate. I mean, so much of this film was deliberate and so many choices were just so painfully agonized over, from the color of their bedsheet to the curtains to you know, the music and everything in between. I think one thing that was so tricky in having such a specific and quiet, in many cases, soundscape is that such prominence was placed on the lyrics of songs in a way that just became unavoidable. And there are occasions where it is firmly in the background and is more of a feeling than a focus on what is being said. But there are other points where those songs began to tell the story. And often, like, I didn't choose them knowing that they had the capacity to do that, but we discovered that they did or they were. And then you're faced with either leaning into that or pushing away from it. But either way, it's going to be true in moments where the music is one of the most prominent things in the scene. And so it was something interesting to navigate.
Yeah, I wonder how you chose Losing My Religion as the song that young Sophie does in the movie. And so many of those instances where people are doing karaoke or the lounge singer, that you let us listen to a very long section of the song, and she performs all of Losing My Religion.
There is actually a verse cut out, much to my disappointment, because I would quite happily have heard that twice as long as we do in the film. But it certainly does feel that way. And yeah, I mean, I'm quite content to watch people, especially people, perform on screen. I think there's just something so captivating about it. And Frankie's performance of Losing My Religion was just so fantastic. And it was something that we'd worked on for weeks. Not the performance, but just convincing her to get on that stage, which Paul reminded me recently did at one point involve me standing there singing it, screaming it from the top of my lungs. And I cannot sing, Frankie can, to try to convince her to join me. And really the first time she sang it was in that take. But she had once kind of spoken it through on the stage. And that song, truthfully, I did at certain points consider what other options might be. That's a song that I had a kind of history with. It was probably the first song I ever knew all of the lyrics to, firmly a child of the 90s, and that I remember singing when I was very young. And I chose it based on instinct, which is true of many of the musical choices in the film, that kind of, as I was just speaking to, turned out to work very well and be appropriate in a certain way to the moment. But that's a song where I think its underlying meaning is often kind of misinterpreted. I kind of like that too, that it felt like it was working on lots of different fronts.
Well, I just thought that having those two songs come so close to each other, Unchained Melody and Losing My Religion, and, you know, and thinking about the sort of the plaintive quality of Unchained Melody and the irony and melancholy of Michael Stipe in Losing My Religion, I mean, having those two things being almost juxtaposed is really covers a lot of emotional ground, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, Unchained Melody is just so, feels so romantic, you know, just in tone. That was, you know, like us playing against what we were seeing on screen at that point a little bit. But yeah, I mean, songs have a capacity to evoke feeling with such immediacy that I think film doesn't. And so when you place a song like that into a film, it is always going to be very striking. And Unchained Melody always felt correct there. It was a choice and it wasn't cheap. But I felt quite strongly that is what it should be.
And of course, it's used in the movie Ghost, which I can't not think about sort of the implications of all of that.
That is so true. And I hadn't thought of it until now.
Really?
Well, yeah. Yeah. there are things like that I really do think sit in my subconscious that play into these decisions, you know, that only reveal themselves much later. But that will change the way I see that whenever, if ever, I watch the film again.
This says a lot about you as a director. We will take a break. My guest is writer-director Charlotte Wells, whose terrific first film is After Sun. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/thetreatment. My guest is the incredibly detailed, specific, but still find some things come out of her subconscious, writer-director of After Sun, Charlotte Wells. You're talking about verses unheard, and there's a verse from Under Pressure that is not often played in movies that is really sort of key to a certain section of the movie that I don't want to give too much away about. But, I mean, I like the way that these songs have this kind of weight that feels both conscious and subconscious simultaneously.
Yeah, it's true. And Under Pressure was a discovery in the edit. And those lyrics felt like a discovery for us too. I don't know what it was that inspired bringing of that into the cut. It was knowing the song. It was knowing this stripped back version that I would listen to in awe of both of their voices and just looking for something to inspire the emotion I think I was trying to create in that scene. I think that was really why I brought it in. It wasn't really with the intention that it would be the soundtrack. And we dropped it into the timeline. It played over the temp score that we were working with at that moment, and it just was something. It was irrefutably something. And if our producers, who were the only people who saw that very first assembly cut, had told us it was something completely absurd and terrible, I think we might have believed them because it felt so audacious to allow the lyrics to carry such weight and to align so literally with what you were seeing on screen in a way that we'd really shoot every other turn in making the film. But they saw something in it too. And I think at that point, we were faced with the challenge of building sufficiently to earn that moment in the film and to earn something so literal and straightforward and earnest as far as the lyrics and what's happening on screen aligning by laying quite subtly the parts that would build up to it.
Whenever I see the bed scenes in your movies, I think about that last scene of Sunday.
Tuesday,
I'm sorry. Whenever there's a bed scene in your films, and certainly they're there. And after Sun, I find myself sort of going back to that, you know, just what sitting on a bed and waiting means for somebody.
The final scene of Tuesday was the moment that I realized I wanted to make films. You know, like I had been in film school as a producer and I'd been given this chance to make a short and I took it without question. But in so many ways, I felt like I was fashioned by the professors that I'd had and what we were watching in class. And that was a moment where I just had this idea. I had this idea that I could express a feeling that I had by holding and waiting with her in that room and, you know, like drenched in that kind of sodium vapor light from outside in the dark and then allowing her to leave. And then allowing, speaking of Ghost, the camera to kind of take on its own person, you know, and to move through the room and to shift the perspective at the end of the film and to watch her leave at the window. And it was just an idea and we did it and it felt like something that was so satisfying. And I think that was a moment where, like speaking of kind of naturalism in performance, that was like a first step away from something that was bound just by reality, I think. And I think that continued in the next short and in Blue Christmas, which has a climax not unlike After Sun, which again is something that only became absolutely obvious to me in the edit, to which my editor, I'll save you the... the surprise, because my editor just looked at me like I was utterly mad and said, "You have to be joking that you didn't realize that you were doing the same thing." And that will always be true, I think, to some degree. And I don't ever want to realize until it's done and I've figured out exactly how it's different.
It's the truth. My guest has been incredibly polite about not correcting me about getting the name of her first film wrong. It's Tuesday, although Sunday plays a part in it. Tuesday is my guest, Charlotte Well, who goes back to memory more often than she thinks she does. And I think her new film, After Sun, the beautiful After Sun, is suffused with that. It's incredible to me because clearly your films are motivated by subconscious and unconscious in ways you don't even understand. Because I was trying to get to talking about Blue Christmas and the echoes. And when you brought it up and said you weren't cognizant of it...
Yeah, I mean, no, it's tricky. Like, maybe I was cognizant of it 7 years ago when I started, or at least, you know, I made Blue Christmas in 2017. And I remember the moment that I wrote that dance sequence at the end because I'd been watching some Pina Bausch and suddenly the end of the film became somewhat movement and dance oriented. And, you know, there's this break between reality and fantasy of sorts for... I don't know. At some point, I must have been aware of that. And maybe I'm just glad, I gladly forget. But I do think, you know, I once said after I'd made the shorts, but before I was really underway with After Sun, that there was a through line of kind of denial or avoidance in the shorts. And I do think that's true. And I think there is a certain amount of denial required in making a project that is so personal and in allowing yourself to think it's about something and then allowing it to reveal itself to you that it's actually about something else. I think it would be difficult to confront what it is really about right at the beginning, at least for me. You know, I find that I have to ease myself into it, even if that is apparently with absolute self-delusion.
I was thrilled to see that the dancing in After Sun and Avid Trigger Blue Christmas for me. And I just thought, wow, of course. Because, you know, the echoes in Tuesday, I'm getting the title right this time, but also the way these films feel in one way or another, like they all complete each other. They're all part of a conversation, if not a specific ABC narrative. Do you know what I mean?
It took me a long time to draw the line between Tuesday and After Sun. There are parallels in some way. There are ways in which Tuesday is a, or After Sun, I suppose, is a prequel of sorts, just a different time. But yeah, I don't think for a long time I saw them as being as connected as they obviously are, partly because I had been so focused on the filmmaking progression from film to film and trying to figure out what it was that I was doing. And my tastes kind of shifted in what I was watching over the course of making those films. And certainly by the time that I began pre-production process on After Sun, was aware that I'd be trying things that were new, you know, and looking to shoot it in a way that was a little bit different than the shorts, which even from a camera perspective, that those films had all been somewhat handheld. Laps wasn't, but because it was shot in a subway, it felt like it was in a lot of ways at times, and in the water. It was a bit of a mix. But even just formally knowing that After Sun was a progression, I'd been so focused on the filmmaking, this is all to say, that I was sometimes oblivious to the thematic through lines.
It's The Treatment. We're talking about the Charlotte Wells cinematic universe with its creator, writer-director Charlotte Wells. Her directorial debut as a feature filmmaker is a terrific film, After Sun. You can also see the show at kcrw.com. But, I mean, I love the echoes, and I hope people get a chance to seek these films out, just because there also are these enormous leaps. I mean, there's that going from hearing Sophie sing Losing My Religion to the conversation where her father offers to get her singing lessons, which seems both respectful, parental, and slightly cruel, and then her response and the kind of conversation that, you know, that years later will fill her with regret. I mean, those are things that didn't happen in those shorts, those kinds of conversations. Whereas I can see the connections, and then people who've seen the films can. There's certainly a great leap forward, I think, not only in filmmaking confidence, but also confidence of characters to say things that reveal more with time than they seem to.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about film school is that people generally write bad dialogue because they're figuring out how to write. And I say this of myself, and the advice that was often given was just to remove the dialogue, which means that the films, like more often than not, were extremely light on dialogue. And I think it took some time to find my feet in writing After Sun. And it's one of the things when writing, I do feel most self-conscious about. But again, the time that I had to work on this, like I really did learn a lot and found a lot of joy in writing dialogue, because it's one of the parts of writing where there's most discovery, you know, where you might have an idea for a scene and how it plays out and what it is that you're trying to express or progress or whatever it is. But dialogue is something that you start somewhere and aren't necessarily quite sure what you will conjure, and whether that will be based on something you heard or something somebody else heard that was relayed to you, or whether it is just fashioned by your imagination. And I find that part really exciting. And it's also about balancing conversations that have a lot of import in the moment, conversations that may have seemed very banal in the moment that you come back to for the rest of your life, dialogue that does feel quite naturalistic, dialogue that feels very authentic to a kid, which is often very earnest, which sometimes made me cringe when I wrote myself, in finding that line between my voice and Sophie's voice and allowing her to be earnest in the way that kids are and you know, voice thoughts that they've been carrying. Yeah, you're kind of walking all of these different lines.
You mentioned Paul in the first half. You're referring to Paul Mescal, who plays her dad. And you're talking about the dialogue. And what I found interesting about the dialogue, too, in After Sun is that in some ways that her father's dialogue evokes, we can hear how similar they are. And he can be as earnest as she sometimes. Like the scene we were just talking about, where he's talking about getting her music lessons. And it's, there's this need to sort of connect and to be seen and to be heard and not realizing the implications of what's being said in real time.
One of the most essential parts to Callum's character and his relationship to Sophie is the degree to which he gave little consideration to his own future, but put so much stock in hers. And so that is a moment in which I think he sees himself as giving her opportunity, when in fact what she needed was maybe a little bit of encouragement or love in that moment, which is certainly not in short supply elsewhere. But it is a moment where his own fixation on his ambition for her kind of blinds him to what she needs from him in that moment, and then causes her to speak aloud something that she has observed, which is the kind of thing that kids pick up on, you know, like stress, the stress that parents believe they conceal but don't successfully. And in this case, you know, regarding money and feeling so much on offer, but simultaneously knowing that the resources to provide that are in short supply, and feeling hurt in a moment and snapping. And it was a really challenging and enjoyable moment on set, because at the cost of other things that evening, we really did try it lots of different ways. And Frankie was quite uncomfortable actually with that line and with really allowing Sophie to be upset with Callum. And we kind of pushed different degrees of how angry she was, I would say. And likewise with him. And I mean, that is one of my favorite moments in the performance, in Paul's performance there. There was a different take that we had for much of the edit, but then we found this moment where he laughs and he diffuses it and he doesn't rise to it and tries to bring her back on site, because that is a day within the holiday where they're just constantly missing each other. They're both trying at different points and they're never really on the same page for very long. And so just seeing him try to bring her back on site and then realizing it's not going to happen and getting up quite abruptly and leaving, I think what Paul does there is so lovely.
Well, there's a lot of loveliness in this film and in all of your work, including your latest film, your directorial debut as a feature filmmaker, After Sun. And of course, the director of Tuesday, listen to this closely, Tuesday, my guest is writing director Charlotte Wells. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Charlotte, and I really like your work a lot, and I hope you come back and do the show again.
Thank you so much. I would love to.
After a stellar and apparently self-consciously motivated group of short films, director Charlotte Wells' feature filmmaking debut is After Sun. All kinds of journeys, intentional and otherwise, are at kcrw.com/thetreatment. Join us. Stay on the bus with The Treatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's funny the things that you remember, but one of the lines that's always stuck with me is a line from the book by Jerry Stahl, Permanent Midnight. I think the line goes something like, "The soul, I believe, allows you to forget trauma." I'm sure that's not entirely true, because Jerry's career has been about sort of detailing the impact that trauma can have, and his newest book, 999. I'll let him explain to you what the title means, but my guest is our old friend Jerry Stahl. It's great to have him back. Jerry, thank you so much for doing this. Before we get started, that line is always really like a tattooed in my head. I just remember that that line from Permanent Midnight.
Yeah. Well, when it comes to trauma, I mean, everybody's good at something. So that's my forte. But I think the other half of that line is that the memory lives on in the cells, that you you have that soul thing going on, and it also lives on in the deep recesses of your physical being.
Well, it's funny, because as we're talking about that book, I guess another line that comes to mind for me, and I wonder if it applies to this new book, is you said at one point in the book that it's less an exercise in recall than an exorcism. And does this new book feel like that too?
On some level, everything that I write is a kind of exorcism. But on another, this is a subject, obviously, on some level that is much bigger than me, the Holocaust. Yet at the same time, being a member of the human race, on some level, you can't help but make it about yourself.
Well, if you could, first of all, explain what the title means. But before that, explain what the book is about.
Some of it is explained in the subtitle, One Man's Tale of Depression, Psychic Torment, and a Bus Tour of the Holocaust. That old routine. So in a nutshell, I was super depressed back in around 2016, and I hope you can't relate. This is sort of mildly pre-Trump in those naive days. And I thought, you know, where better on the planet when you were just gripped by total soul-crushing despair? Where is that feeling appropriate? And it's like, well, how about the concentration camps? So I found a way for Vice magazine to send me over there, take a tour. We're talking dream vacation here. Take a tour by bus of Auschwitz, Buchenwald, and Dachau, and points in between in Germany and Poland. So that is the genesis of the book.
But a lot of the book, too, is about going back to not being able to forget trauma, just about how much of your past life you can't shake, and who you are informs everything you do, and somehow thinking you're going to go to some place with concerns bigger than you would change you in some ways, and obviously in ways it does, but you are left to reckon with the fact that in some crucial ways it did not change you.
No, in fact, it confirmed in some horrific and hopefully somewhat hilarious way that, you know, you just take yourself with you. I had these big dramatic plans. I'm going to show up and I'm going to step on this hallowed ground and have this complete down to my toes spirit infusing experience. But of course, being a man of a certain age, before I get there, I really had to pee. So I just get off the bus and I'm like shot out of a cannon. And then I come back out and I'm again ready to have that experience. And the first thing I see is some goober with an I'm with stupid t-shirt slamming Fanta and eating pizza at the Auschwitz snack bar. So all my preconceptions, as happens in life, were instantly shattered before I could have that soul-changing experience.
It's the treatment. Our guest is our old friend Jerry Stahl, whose new book, probably the funniest book ever to include a non-existent quote by Oscar Levant, is 999. One of the things that strikes me about the book, and also fits into so much of your writing, is the extent to which you think people have your number as soon as they see you, and the sort of flights of fancy in your head about their preconceptions of you and how you're going to fit into those or not fit into those.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of this comes from having been a dope fiend for many years, but I was never that guy who quote-unquote partied. I was the guy who didn't want to, like, hear your party. And I always tried to pass as, like, being straight, you know? Like William Burroughs said, why do you use heroin? So I can get up in the morning and shave, you know? So to some extent, though I let go of the heroin decades ago, I still have that feeling that I'm trying to pass as some kind of normal person in a world that clearly, as you say, has my number.
Well, I think that's why my mind was racing back to Permanent Midnight, because there's this constant paranoid streak in that book of people being able to suss out what you think is your secret. And as you say in that book, it's the worst kept secret in the world. But here, in so many funny ways, this idea of people who seem like authority figures to you, be it the teachers or the woman from the same district court as where your dad once presided as a judge. I mean, some of these people who you think sort of know you and sort of don't.
Yeah. And one of the grimmest lessons in life is when you create these paranoid fantasies, you end up projecting them onto the people whom you are paranoid about. And then they, of course, begin to like manifest the very things you worried about because you've kind of forced them into it. You know, if you act like a weirdo, people are going to think you're weird. And nothing will make you weirder than trying to act like you are not, in fact, a weirdo.
I wanted to ask if you were trying to evoke permanent midnight when you talk, we write early on in the book about how having been straight for a number of years, now you have to reckon with the fact that it's not the drugs that are making you act that way. It's essentially who you are.
Yeah, that's a very interesting point. It reminds me when I first got clean, the guy, the kind of a mentor who ushered me through was a writer named Hubert Selby, you know, Requiem for a Dream, Last Exit to Brooklyn. And I remember whining, like, oh, man, you know, if I'm not using dope, you know, I'm just going to be so square. I'm going to lose my edge. And he just looked at me, and this is a family show, so I'm not going to use his language. He's like, you don't know how effing crazy you are until you get off of everything. And then you're basically naked under the world, and you can't blame the drugs. That's the essential lesson of drug addiction that nobody tells you. When you act like an idiot on, say, heroin or alcohol or anything, you can blame the drugs or the booze. But when you act like, you know, an a-hole on the Natch, it's pretty much just you.
It's funny because that's, I think, again, like I was saying, as we've been saying here, what triggered so much of Permanent Midnight for me is these kind of revelations about you at this point now in your 60s coming to the realization that you are who you are and you just have to, I'm not going to say make peace with it because I think that's impossible for you to do, but to come to some understanding that there are some essential parts of you that aren't going to change.
Right. And in terms of concentration camps, one question I had was always, how long after, let's say, your basic barber or lawyer or hotel running concierge, you know, when these people just get into the camp, how soon do their ambitions and fears and dreams and obsessions, how soon do they fade away and get reduced to sheer survival? And it's a question, you know, I was always asking myself as I was walking through this terrifying, really incomprehensibly horrific world.
It's so interesting because, again, I mean, I feel like there's so much of you. This really feels like a bookend to Permanent Midnight because that same kind of fear of being overcome with fear and the places that were very normal and then to be revisited by those same kinds of fears and anxiety in a place where that has such a horrific history. I just found it to be really fascinating about how, again, some part of you remains the same, but being in this circumstance, it does force you to ask questions that you never thought about before.
It does. And it also makes you realize that you're not alone. People are who they are. I was in a gas chamber. I think it was Auschwitz. It might have been Dachau. And this young sort of hipster couple began bickering. You know, they might as well have been at a Starbucks. You know, and they start barking at each other. And I'm like in the back looking at them like, can you believe? But it's like, of course that's going to happen because people are people and there's no such thing as appropriate behavior at the end of the day. Whatever you are is just going to leak out. And there they were.
I guess I was wondering, too, as you were writing these pieces that became this, if you kind of saw an overarching foundation, if I can mix metaphors here, structurally, before you start to write, or did you just sort of let yourself loose and open to the experience?
Interestingly enough, for the original six pieces, which form a small part, but sort of the gateway into the whole thing, I did not really write about my own emotions or my own feelings that much. It was kind of more of a sort of gonzo, just the facts, ma'am, thing. But it wasn't as gonzo as what happened later, because to me, what that kind of journalism, you know, Hunter Thompson Beyond is you plunge yourself into some grotesque situation and then write about how you are reacting to the grotesque situation. So it's as much about you as it is the situation. And just to give you an example, I did that kind of journalism for years, where one weekend I would find myself at the Elysium nude resort for a, like, clothing optional singles weekend at Elysium in Topanga. And, you know, you have these moments where you're standing there in the buffet line with, like, the chicken salad gently brushing, you know, people's genitalia. And you're just like, I can't believe I'm here. So you're writing as much about the chicken salad as you are about your reaction to what's happening. Probably a totally egregious thing to jump into now that I'm thinking about our original subject. But it is the same dynamic. The difference being that with the Holocaust, of course, your real subject is what happened there. And the revelation I had is that even thinking you can fully, artfully, or even honestly describe your reaction, it's almost disrespectful to the people who suffered there. And that's what I came away with.
Thinking back to those Vice pieces, which were really laden with detail, but just observation about what the place was, by placing yourself in the middle of it, it really gives it this kind of interesting thing. You're asking yourself questions about who you are constantly in a way that, again, I feel like it's just very much who you are as a writer and a reporter.
Of course. You want to be wholly present, you know. God knows, I would have loved to be like, you know, William Shire, you know, writing about the last days of the Third Reich. But instead, I'm me, and I'm there. And you know, life follows you. As I was at the camps, at the same time that happened, I was on a deadline for a really ill-considered gig where, you know, somebody optioned my last book, OG Dad, which was about, you know, this happy circumstance of, like, marrying a much younger woman and having a father at an inappropriately old age. But by the time I have to write the thing, the marriage has fallen apart. The kids moved to Austin with mom, you know, and the whole thing. You know, I'm much better at divorce than I am marriage, Elvis. You know, we always get along once we're separated. So that worked out. But the thing of it is, I'm dealing with these executives calling up, and I make the, and this is on me, just the insane mistake of, like, answering the phone as I stagger out of a chamber. And it's like some creepy executive who had never even read the book. They just heard me on another podcast because, you know, why read when you can podcast? And he's like, can you make Jerry less weird? You know, and in that sense, of course, it's like Permanent Midnight because the subject is not me, it's Jerry. And you end up talking about yourself in the third person in some sort of meta Pirandello-esque way that you didn't anticipate. And it's a nightmare and it's inappropriate and it's entirely human. And there you are.
You mentioned Tony Bourdain in the book, and part of me had always wondered if the book that he wrote, his Kitchen Confidential, and some of the essays that he did were inspired by Permanent Midnight.
Well, that's not something I would ever say because he was his own man, you know, and if that's something you sense, that's something you sense. But what he cursed me with in an odd way was he wrote in the New York Times that if anybody could write his story, his obituary, it would be me. When he died, of course, the last thing I wanted to do was write about him because people were coming out of the woodwork to say they were his best friends and join in the pile-on of exploiting a dead man. And I remember I interviewed Brando years and years ago on his island in Tetiaroa, which is a whole other story. But I asked him about this book by a guy named Carlo Fiori called Bud, The Brando I Knew, which just outed him on all kinds of levels. And he said, basically, you know, friends don't write about friends. And that stuck with me. And I sort of did not avail myself of the many opportunities to write about him after he died. If anybody thinks that book has anything to do with Permanent Midnight, I mean, I'm honored because that is just a fantastic book. And if that inspired him, so be it. I knew him a little bit, but I think he didn't need me to be who he was.
That's not what I'm saying, but I am saying this idea of, and there's this sort of kinship in that kind of writing that connects you guys, that gets to Burroughs too, this idea of sometimes looking for chaos where there is none or having a need to sort of create chaos because there's a sensitivity in both of you that is so sort of harshly met by the world at large that chaos seems to be the only response.
ultimately, I think the eternal question is, do you create that chaos or does that chaos find you? If chaos is the lens through which you see the world, and if that's what inspires you, then you're going to live in a pretty chaotic world, right?
Yeah, but there's this kind of attention to detail and being aware of yourself and your surroundings constantly, which is this thing that informs so much of your writing. It makes this stuff so much fun to read. It always sort of strikes me as being this, almost like you're in some ways missing a membrane, this sort of constancy of describing things. Almost, again, I go back to Permanent Midnight, and I always wonder, part of that reason to, for all the other things you said about taking drugs, was just to sort of keep all that chaos at bay, because your antenna are constantly going off.
I always viewed using narcotics as, you know, those late night ads when they say, like, consolidate your debts. You know, all the panicky, nightmarish concerns that are tearing you apart, you can just forget them and, you know, just squeeze them into one big ball, which is, I need dope, you know? So when you're living like that and you're an addict, life is black and white, and then you're off the drugs and suddenly life's a gray area and there's just a million other things you need to take care of and you can't obliterate them with one overriding need. So perhaps, sort of playing off what you were saying, that's where the chaos is. And perhaps that's the real addiction, is the chaos.
I really would love to see the Oscar Levant movie that Natasha Lyonne was going to direct. In fact, we've talked about this before, because you've been working on the screenplay for a while.
Yeah, with our late friend Stuart Kornfeld. It was his idea to even approach me about it.
There's a line in the open, I don't want to give away because I want people to read the book, that's really... For a second, I thought, did I read that? It's not only so in his voice, but it's his meter.
Please go ahead.
Oh, I don't want to screw it up because it's a line about depression. And that's all I will say, because I want people to read the book. But also, what I'm trying to say, too, is that you even got his meter. I mean, it sounded like his count, his rhythm, because there was something kind of musical in the way that he delivered those kind of aperçus. There's so much jumping around sort of in personality terms, and you're trying on so many different personae in the book that it's almost like being in this kind of hurricane of thought and feeling.
That's how the book came out. It took me 4 or 5 years before I could start it. And when I did, it just came screaming out, you know, whole cloth. But the thing about Levant is he was a huge influence. A lot of people don't know this, but he was talking about narcotics before Lenny Bruce was. And he was on the air in Los Angeles on his own show, which people would watch for the sole reason of seeing if this was the day he finally collapsed on the air. He was living in the Edgemont Mental Hospital above Sunset Boulevard and would take an ambulance to his show. I mean, how can you not love that guy? He lived for the wisecrack. You know, I knew Doris Day before she was a virgin. So I suppose his voice and his meter, as you would say, is something that just I absorbed because he was such a huge influence. And that's why we wanted to do the movie about him.
But there's something about that I do, is sort of confessing your sins in real time before people have a chance to call you out on them, that I think sort of links you to him.
That's a very good observation. And, you know, I'm going to march out the line you may have been alluding to. The line that I attributed to him wholly dishonestly and completely made up in his meter, which is, you know, self-loathing is just narcissism with its pants,
his pants on backwards.
Which sounds like something he would say. And a lot of times in my journalism, I will just cop to this. I really wish people would have said these things that I invented and attributed to them, because it means so much more coming from them than it came from me.
By the way, it's the treatment, I guess, is Jerry Stahl. His newest book, a terrific book, by the way, as of course we should expect, is 999. But have other people brought up Permanent Midnight? Because there's a section early in the book where you talk about being around meat and kielbasa, that you've been a vegetarian just to keep healthy for a long time. And the anxiety, sort of sweat under your fingernails, just reminds me of sections like, you know, you're shooting up on the ALF stage. I mean, have other people connected this to Permanent Midnight before, Jerry? I'm just curious.
Yeah, they certainly have connected it to Permanent Midnight. In a way, the sort of thumbnail description of the book, it's Permanent Midnight with the Holocaust instead of heroin.
because I've been obsessed with Nazis and Nazidom and that whole grim package of what happened all the way back, you know, to Martin Luther, you know, cursing the Jews as a foul race of like unclean pigs, you know. And it's just something that, for whatever reason, the older I get, the less able I am to let go of.
I guess I have to say, too, because I've actually been to Auschwitz myself, and it's astonishing how engineered it was towards its singular goal. I mean, it's breathtaking in its sheer horribleness as you walked through this place. And the other thing that's just chilling, too, is that people live near there. There are apartment complexes not far from Auschwitz that you pass on the way there.
There are beautiful little gingerbread houses. And I remember reading that these old Hausfrauen would complain because they just couldn't figure out why their laundry was so dingy, you know, when these ashes were falling out of the sky. It just never occurred to them that human beings were being incinerated, you know, right down their scenic lane. Eisenhower, of all people, after the war, marched some townspeople into Dachau just to show them what was going on. And of course, they were suitably horrified and had no idea. So that is one of the more pernicious and disturbing details, for sure.
You asked the question about people going there. What is it they were seeking to get out of going there? In the same way that you're asking yourself that, I think what's really great about the book, and again, I don't want to give too much away, is that you don't really ever come to a specific answer about it.
I'm not sure there is an answer, or if there is, it eludes me. But, you know, it's one of these, I'm going to march out a very cornball beatitude. But, you know, it's one of those journey is the destination things. It's looking for that answer that really, really is the answer. And you find yourself in pursuit of something that is elusive because either the reality is too horrible to grasp, or there is no there in the end. You know, what happened is just what happened. And that's what mankind is. And the miracle is not that there was this genocide, but that the genocide ever stops. There's a time between genocides.
Well, that's probably as good a place as any to end it. Although the point is, I'm sorry this conversation has to come to an end because it's been too long since I've spoken to you. My guest is Jerry Stahl. His terrific new book is 999. And Jerry, thanks so much for taking the time to do this. It's really such a great read.
Thanks so much, man. And I loved your documentary. And thank you for having me on the show.
Author Jerry Stahl's latest tome on keeping track of his anxieties and bigger issues is 999, One Man's Tale of Depression, Psychic Torment, and a Bus Tour of the Holocaust, is out now. Jerry's previous conversations and other authors' interviews are yours to hear at kcrw.com/thetreatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Malthus Mitchell with The Treat. Of course, Paul Feig has made a career of surprising himself, so there's no reason that his treat shouldn't be off the beaten track as well. It's something he can see and touch.
Hi, I'm Paul Feig, and this is The Treat. What has inspired me in my life? I mean, there's so many things that inspire me. As a filmmaker, there's so many movies that really changed my life and all that. But if I had to pick the one thing that sort of changed my life the most, it was a paperweight. What? Does that make any sense? It will in 1 second. I was a struggling actor. I had been a stand-up comedian. I'd gone to film school. But I, you know, was as an actor, I would just kind of sitting around waiting for the phone to ring, you know, because you would have auditions. Occasionally your agent would call and send you out an audition. But it was a lot of sort of like, oh, I can't wait for the job to come and it's going to work. It was very frustrating. And then I sat around a lot. And I was in a store one day and there was a paperweight, this kind of fake Scrimshaw paperweight. sitting there in this little gift place. And it had a picture of a boat, and it said, "Don't wait for your ship to come in, swim out to it." And it sounds really dumb and really trite and is just a goofy little curio, tchotchke. But I suddenly went, that's right. It's right. I've been sitting around waiting for people to call, waiting for the job to come in. And I should be writing. I should be out doing stand-up comedy. I should be actively promoting myself. And that was the thing that made me go, you know what? I got to change my life. You know, I'd always been kind of noodling with scripts, but it really made me go, I got to write feature scripts, you know, and sat down and wrote a bunch. You know, I had a whole, you know, the infamous, everybody's got the drawer full of unproduced scripts. And I've got that too. None that I would go back to, but they, you know, helped get me to where I am. I still have that paperweight. It sits right on my desk at my office. And I'm constantly trying to swim out to my ship. So don't wait for your ship to come in. Swim out to it, my friends, with a paper wave.
Paul Feig with a treat that has actual and figurative weight. Previous treats include someone Paul Feig has worked with, John Hamm. What else connects the treat? Inspiration. Reflections on moments and objects that have set the creative lives of figures from the cinema to the literary world, from style to music into motion. Rebecca Mooney produces and edits the program. Katie Gilchrist mixes the show. We had help this week from Anna Buss, Laura Kondarajan, and Desmond Taylor. Hola, Poppy. Me, I can use all the help I can get. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.